The Right Question is funded by the Steele Reese Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
What's the biggest challenge facing a gay teenager living in rural Montana?
I think it's silence. I was just back in Miles City recently, and I think that even though on the national landscape there are all kinds of conversations happening right now that certainly weren't happening when I was a closeted gay kid growing up in Miles City, I think actually within Miles City and certainly within the halls of the high school, there's still a lot of shame and silence around any LGBTQ issue. So you might have friends who in the parking lot would be a kind of ally, but in the classroom or in the hallway would be pretty silent on the issue. So I think many students and maybe some faculty and administration are just not ready to talk about issues of LGBTQ identity. They don't see a place for it in the high school.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features writers from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, and my guest this time is Emily Danforth, author of The Miseducation of Cameron Post. It's a novel about a lesbian teenager in Miles City, Montana.
Was there a certain event or events that prompted you to write this novel?
There were several. One was just my interest in the American coming-of-age narrative, and these are books that I've read since I was a very early reader, so I'm talking books certainly like Catcher in the Rye or To Kill a Mockingbird, but I'm also talking about books like White Oleander or Curtis Sittenfeld's Prep, and I feel like I've gotten something from these quintessentially American coming-of-age stories for a long time, early on maybe just because I was recognizing rites of passage that I was going through. But later, as a writer, there were things that I could appreciate about style or how, you know, Jeffrey Eugenides' The Virgin Suicides is this sort of subversion of the traditional coming-of-age novel, and he tells it from this choral point of view. So it's the community's coming-of-age around these horrific suicides of one family. So I always knew that I'd write one, and I think that was a piece of it. I knew that my first novel would probably be a coming-of-age novel. And I had been reading several novels of development about orphans right as I got started to write this novel. And so I at some point decided that Cameron would probably be an orphan herself. And I knew that I would tackle growing up gay in rural Montana. So those are all things that I knew going into the project. But that none of those things does a novel make. You know, those are just sort of ideas in the sky about, okay, well, I have this sort of frame for a narrative, and she's going to go through rites of passage, and she'll come of age in some way, and she'll be gay, and that won't be okay. When I was home the first summer that I was working on the book, which was summer while I was in the MFA program here, the summer between my 2 years, I learned about a teenager named Zach Stark who's posted on his MySpace page, he was a teenager from Tennessee, that his parents were sending him to a Pray Your Gay Away camp, essentially, in Tennessee. And this caught the national attention pretty quickly. He'd posted this on his personal page and people passed it around. And then he posted some of the rules of this conversion or reparative therapy camp. And that eventually there was a New York Times article even about this and sort of an outcry. And I'd heard a little bit about conversion therapy before, and I'd seen a satirical movie about it called But I'm a Cheerleader. But I'd not thought particularly critically about it, and I'd certainly done no research. And I realized that Cameron would be sent to a facility like this. And so that started then, you know, a year and a half, 2 years of research on the topic and became a crucial part of the novel.
Well, when the story opens, it's summertime, and Cameron Post and her friend Irene are headed for the swimming pool. Tell us how old they are and describe the dynamics of their relationship at the time.
They're 12, sort of a precocious 12 going on 13, and many of their discussions revolve around the fact that they'll be 13 soon. And Irene, anyway, sees that as a real landmark age, that things are supposed to sort of naturally happen to you once you turn 13, and Cameron scoffs at that a little bit. And the dynamic is that they're both best friends and rivals, and that's how Cam describes it in the novel. They share all these interests, but they're always competing with one another, and they're always trying to one-up each other. And there are some areas in which Cam knows that Irene sort of outshines her, and so then she has to make up for it in other areas. And you mentioned the swimming pool. Irene's not a particularly good swimmer. Cam is, and so she feels the need often to show off a little bit. They're very, very close. They've got a long history together, but they're competitive.
And they dare each other.
They do. When the novel opens, they've been daring each other in a variety of ways all day, this sort of day they've spent together in the absence of Cam's parents. And one dare leads to the next, and eventually they're up in the hayloft of Irene's parents' barn, and they dare each other to kiss, essentially. And it really is Irene's dare, and they've been dancing around this topic a little bit. But once Irene makes it a dare, Cam gives herself the permission to do it, and she would not have if it hadn't been a dare. But because they've got this history together, she feels okay. Since Irene makes it a dare, okay, I can do this thing.
And you mentioned that Cameron's parents are gone.
They are.
They're off on a summer vacation to Quake Lake.
Right.
And a car crash happens, and they end up drowning in that lake,
right,
which triggers a storm of shame and grief.
Right.
And fear, right, but it's also tinged with relief that her parents will never find out about that kiss. And there's a passage that illustrates that really well. Do you mind reading that?
No, I'd love to. In the days before the funeral, Irene stopped by the house with her mom, and she called to speak with me a few times after that. And all those times I asked Aunt Ruth to tell Irene that I was napping. People kept sending me all sorts of things, so I knew that even if I ignored her, it was only a matter of time before she sent me something too. It came the same day the swim team sent a big bouquet of sunflowers, a box of cookies, and a card that everyone signed. Coach Ted must have passed it around right after practice because there were all these water spots where wet swimmers had handled it, smudged the ink. Most of the kids just signed their names. Some wrote, "I'm sorry." I wondered what I would have signed if I'd just been one of those wet swimmers, practice over, my towel around my waist, chewing on a granola bar and waiting for my turn to sign the card for the teammate who'd lost both of her parents. I decided I'd probably have been one of the ones who just signed her name, too. Aunt Ruth had been putting everything on the dining room table, but even with both of the extra leaves in, we were running out of room, and she started just setting stuff anywhere that was free space. The whole of the main floor smelled like a flower shop, and with the heat, the shades drawn on all the windows, that scent of roses and irises and carnations and on was almost cloudy, like a gas. It made me hold my breath. I found the bouquet of pink baby roses and an envelope with Cam written on it over on the oak buffet that my dad had refinished. I could tell they were from Irene without even opening the card. I just could. So I peeled the card from the vase, took it up to my room. Alone on my bed with the door shut, the thick heat all around me, the card on my lap weighing almost nothing but seeming full of weight, I felt as criminal as I would have if it had been Irene herself there with me. The card had a night sky on the outside, dozens of stars spread across it, and on the inside something about stars being like memories in the darkness of sorrow. I knew right away that her mom had picked it out. But below that was Irene's cramped cursive, and she had written, "Cam, I wish you would have seen me or answered the phone when I called. I wish I could just talk to you and not write in this card. I wish I didn't even have a reason to send this card at all. I'm sorry, and I love you." She didn't sign her name, but I liked that. I felt flushed when I read what she'd written, and then I read it again and again until I was dizzy with it. I traced my finger over and over the ballpoint, "I love you," and the whole time I felt ashamed, some sicko who just couldn't stop, even after her parents died. I buried that card deep beneath a pile of already spoiled death casseroles in the metal trash can in the alley. I burned my thumb just taking the lid off, the whole can oven hot and reeking. That act of burial felt good, like it meant something, but by that point I had memorized every word she had written me anyway. Grandma and Ruth were out getting things done that needed to be done, going to the funeral parlor, the church. They'd asked me if I wanted to go with them, but I'd said no, though I did spend the rest of that afternoon making my own kinds of funeral arrangements. First, I hauled the TV and VCR from my parents' bedroom, where Ruth had been sleeping, up the steep stairs to my own. I hadn't asked anyone's permission to do this. Who was going to tell me no, or yes even? It was hard work moving that TV, more activity than I'd done for days, and I almost dropped the thing once, my sweaty fingers slipping on its film of dust, its sharp edges poking into my stomach, into my hip bones, while I steadied it against myself, staggered up another stair, rested, then did another. Once I'd situated the TV and VCR on top of my dresser and got everything wired together, plugged in, I went back to my parents' bedroom and straight to the bottom drawer of the dresser, where Dad kept neat rows of white cotton briefs and black socks with gold toes. He had a roll of 10s and 20s hidden in the back, and I took it. And even though I was alone in the house, I stuck it in the waistband of my shorts to hide it. And then I did one more thing, an important thing. I took a photograph housed in a pewter frame and sitting on their dresser top, which was cluttered mostly with snapshots of me. In the picture, my mother is 12, her hair in a stylish page boy, her smile wide and toothy, her knees knobby in shorts, and she is surrounded by trees, the sunlight filtered around her just so, lighting her up. I'd known the story of that photo for as long as I'd known that photo. Grandpa Witten snapped it, August 17th of 1959. And in less than 24 hours, the place where it was taken, Rock Creek Campground, would be torn apart by the worst earthquake in Montana history. And then that place would be flooded by water, sloshing over an upriver dam, and it would become Quake Lake. I put the picture right on top of the TV so I couldn't miss it. Then I put all that cash into the hollowed-out base of the High Point trophy I'd won at the divisional meet the summer before. All that cash except for $110, which I stuck in the inside band of a sweat-stained Miles City Mavericks cap I'd had forever. Dad and I liked to go to their ball games together and eat Polish sausages and laugh at the old guys who swore at the umps. That cap in my hand, its rim of crusty salt stain against the dark blue background, made me almost lose it for a second, but I didn't let myself. I squashed it down over my dirty hair, and then I was off. Save my burial at the trash can. I hadn't been outside since the night Mr. Clausen had driven me home. The glare of the sun felt good, even while it was almost immediately uncomfortable. I felt like I deserved it. My bike had been leaned up against the garage for days in that sunbake, and the metal scorched my legs when they brushed against it. I pedaled as fast as I could, let the sweat from my forehead sting my eyes, blur my vision for a few seconds. I took the alleys and concentrated on the sound of my tires over the loose gravel, on the whir of my gear chain. I came out onto Haines Avenue and pulled into the parking lot of the Video and Go. It was July 2nd, and there was a swarm of cars and bicycles in front of the Golden Dragon fireworks stand in the corner of the lot. The Elks Club ran that stand, and my dad always worked a shift or two. I wondered who was covering for him as I wove my way through the pileup and toward the store, hoping my cap would keep me invisible. I felt like a ghost anyway. I knew just what I was looking for. Beaches. Over with the new releases. I'd gone to see it at the Montana Theater with my mom the year before. We cried and cried. We bought the soundtrack the next day. Then I went back to the Montana and I saw it with Irene. We argued over who, between the two of us, was Bette Midler and who was Barbara Hershey. We both wanted to be Bette. Barbara Hershey's character dies near the end of the movie. Her daughter, Victoria, is left behind like me. She wears a black velvet dress and white tights and gets to hold Bette Midler's hand during the funeral. She was maybe 4 years too young to be my equal and had really only lost one parent because her dad, while absent, was at least still alive. And she was just an actor I knew playing a part, but still, it was something to go by. I felt like I needed something official to show me how all of this should feel, how I should be acting, what I should be saying, even if it was just some dumb movie that wasn't really official at all. It was Mrs. Carvel, formerly Mrs. Hauser, at the register. She taught fourth grade during the school year and worked the video store in the summer. Her parents owned it. I'd had her the first year she'd ever taught, but I wasn't one of her favorites because I didn't take the after-school tap classes she held in the gymnasium, and also maybe because I didn't giggle and ask stupid questions about weddings and dating when she'd brought her then-fiancé, Mr. Carvel, to class one day in the spring and had him do dorky science experiments with us. In the end of your comments on my report card, she had written, "Cameron is very bright. She'll do well, I'm sure." My parents thought this was a riot. Mrs. Carvel took the case from me and found the video to put it in it without much seeing me. But when I had to say post for her to look up our account, she did a double take, peered close beneath the brim of my cap, and flinched. "Oh my God, honey," she said to me, just standing there, sort of gaping, the video stiffed in her hand. "What are you doing in here?" "I'm so sorry about..." I filled it in for her in my head, about how your parents swerved off a mountain road and drowned in a lake that shouldn't even exist, shouldn't even be there. All of this while you stayed home and kissed a girl, stole some gum. "I'm so sorry, just, well, about everything, honey," she finished. There was a high counter between us, and I was glad that she couldn't easily get around it to hug me. "It's okay," I mumbled. "I just really need to rent that right now. I've got to get back home." She looked more carefully at the title, her wide face scrunched up a little, confused, like she was trying to figure this out, like she could really make sense of it. "Well, you just go on and take this then, okay, hun?" she told me, handing it back without ringing it up. "And you can just call me even to come and pick it up when you're finished. You keep it for as long as you want." "Are you sure?" I asked, unaware that this was the first official time of so many to come when I'd received the prorated orphan discount. I didn't like it. I didn't want Mrs. Carville taking care of me. "Of course, Cameron. It's nothing at all." She smiled her big smile at me, one I'd never been granted personally, but had seen on occasion when she'd trotted it out for the whole class to share, like the time our room won the school-wide pop-top collecting contest. "But I have money," I said, feeling like I would cry just any second and keeping my eyes away from hers. "I'm going to want to rent something else soon anyway." "You can rent as many as you like," she said. "You come see me. I'll be here all summer." I couldn't let her do this thing for me. It made me twist up inside. "I'll just leave this then and rent more later," I mumbled, my head down, putting the $10 on the counter and walking as quickly as I could, without technically running, to the door. "Cameron, this is too much," she called after me. But then I was out of the store, back on the sidewalk, free from her generosity or pity or kindness, from all of it.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Emily Danforth about her novel, The Miseducation of Cameron Post. We'll be back shortly to talk more about the book, about religious conversion therapy, and about how online communities are helping gay teens cope with their isolation. Aunt Ruth is now Cameron's legal guardian, and she takes her to a church at Gates of Praise, where she meets Reverend Rick and learns about a place called God's Promise. Tell us what that is.
So God's Promise is a conversion therapy or reparative therapy boarding school, essentially, in the western half of the state. And Reverend Rick doesn't actually work at Gates of Praise, which is the church in Mel City. That Cam gets sent to, but he visits one summer and provides some brochures and talks about the work he does healing sexual dysfunction, essentially, and same-sex attraction disorder at God's Promise. And while in the novel you really could get sent to God's Promise for all kinds of reasons, most of the teenagers who get sent there are sent because their parents have noticed homosexual tendencies in them and don't know how to deal with them. So there's one or two teenagers at God's Promise who have gone there because they wanted to and because they recognize this thing in themselves and are trying to save themselves. But for the most part, it's somewhere that your parents send you or a guardian sends you, which is certainly Cam's case.
Well, one of the characters that Cameron meets at God's Promise, because she gets betrayed and sent there, his name is Adam Red Eagle. And he tells her, quote, "I'm not gay. I'm not even a tranny. I'm like pre-gender or almost like a third gender that's male and female combined." He's a Lakota, and his beliefs don't include gender assignment or the story of Adam and Eve.
Right, right.
So tell us more about him.
Well, you know, I think that this is, without sort of some of the history and some of the spirituality, I think this is arriving at a similar sort of place of belief about gender is something that I see a lot of teenagers doing today. And they're not Lakota and they don't have this sort of background. But I think that I know an emerging sort of queer population who think about gender in these ways. They're not interested in the binary of gender. They feel like that they're able to figure out a way to live their lives where they're neither of those things, or at least they talk more maybe about performing gender and they recognize that. And I think it's something I would hate to say, well, of course, it's universal, but it's something that I've seen from students in my classes and from much, much younger queer activists who, you know, are sort of growing up thinking in these ways and thinking about a big part of what we think of as gender is in fact a kind of performance, and it has a lot less to do with my body, right, or the sexual organs that I was given, and it has to do with these other sorts of things. And certainly Adam comes at it from this personal history, this family history, and then this spiritual history of his people. But that was a way to get at this thing that I think is very interesting, and you know, he's a character who, I mean, there's all kinds of reasons why the doctrine and the rhetoric of God's promise doesn't work for Cam and doesn't work maybe for other students who get sent there. But then he's got these completely other sort of, you know, reasons why the what they're spewing is just never going to apply to him. And so he can't even get to a point where, you know, he can listen very carefully to the things that he's being told because it has nothing to do with his frame of reference, you know. And he's thankfully, you know, he's got enough sense of self to be able to recognize that and hold on to that in this process that seeks to brainwash, essentially. So,
yeah, he thinks of himself as a healer.
Yeah. Yeah, this is his message to share, and that God's promise is not going to drive this out of him, right? That he can sit in the group shares and he can sit in his one-on-one sessions, and he already knows this thing about himself. And it's not actually just God's promise. It's, you know, in the novel, it's his father who's reached a certain sort of level of power in the community that he comes from, that who wants his son essentially straightened out, right? He wants him fixed. And Adam doesn't subscribe to those notions. So he was a really fun character to write. He was one of my favorites. Both he and Jane Fonda, I had a great time with. So, who is of course not actually Jane Fonda. She'd have to read the novel to know that.
Yeah, she's a very fun character. It seems like there are more and more gay characters, you know, in the last decade that have appeared on TV and in movies that are maybe role models and maybe giving the general population a way to talk about this issue. Yeah. Do you think it's getting easier?
I do. I absolutely do. I mean, this is one of the things that it's a big part of Cam's early story is how she has to find queer culture or queer pop culture. And if you think about it, you know, I like to believe because it makes me feel old that the early 90s was not that long ago, but it was, right? Cam's story is 25 years ago, essentially, or the landscape of her journey is about 25 years ago. And I tell people sometimes that I think of this as a historical novel. And of course, people who write historical fiction laugh at me. But in terms of visibility, in terms of some of those characters that you're mentioning from TV or film, they were much fewer and farther between. And so Cam has to really seek that sort of stuff out. And luckily, she meets a character early on in the novel who helps with that. But in a small town, I mean, one of the things that she really goes through, and you saw that a little bit in the section that I read, is that everything that she rents, say, from the local video store, everybody knows about. There's no anonymity. You don't just log on and sort of do your private research. I mean, if she wants to rent, you know, Personal Best, which was an early lesbian movie, or I shouldn't even say lesbian movie, but a movie that had a lesbian relationship or same-sex relationship in it, everybody knows that she's renting that, you know, or anybody that would be in the store and certainly the guy that works there. And these are not always the best models either, or the most positive models, but they're what she can find. And so I do think that visibility is always crucial, and it certainly helps people feel comfortable. People that might not know someone who's out have seen Will and Grace, and that's not a solution, but I do think it's a stepping stone. I absolutely think that visibility is a stepping stone, and you know, I mean, that's one of the powerful things that narrative does. Whatever form narrative comes in, it allows us to, you know, experience other people and other ways of life and other stories. And, you know, with a novel, if you're in a character's head, you're transported to that. And I think that's, you know, that's pretty crucial. And I'm sure that change in visibility helped me to get this novel published. People have asked me frequently, and you didn't really, but I've been asked, you know, was it hard to publish this novel? Or were you asked to change things, some of the content, because they're teenagers? And, you know, the answer on at least to the second question is no. I was never asked to change anything or to, you know, to tone things down or to remove, any of the sexual content, which is all pretty tame. But, that none of those concerns came up, so...
Early in our conversation, you mentioned the It Gets Better project, and that is something that just started recently.
Right. So Dan Savage, who's a syndicated columnist and sort of a personality, a gay personality, and his partner started this, and it really is it's taken off, and so there have been all kinds of both LGBTQ sort of celebrities or personalities, and then allies who have made videos talking about the ways in which middle school and high school and adolescence in general can be really hard for anyone who feels different for any reason. But certainly it was sort of started for LGBTQ kids who don't feel like they have a space in their high school or in their family or in their church or whatever it might be. And it was really a way to hear these stories of other people who came before who also didn't have a space and who have managed to, you know, have successful and fulfilling lives. And I'm both, excited about the campaign, and I think it would have meant a lot to me as a 14 or a 15-year-old to be able to log on and watch these videos. And I mean, I think, even people like Michelle Obama, I mean, there have just been tons and tons of people who have recorded these small segments talking about the ways in which things can get better for you and sort of how big the world is out there, even if it doesn't feel that way sometimes when you're walking through the hallways of your high school. But I also think it's like visibility in whatever form it takes. This is just a step in the right direction because there's—and Dan Savage just talked about this, so I'm not saying anything new, but there's something also sort of essentially problematic in saying— all that we can do for you is tell you that things get better, right? Because that's not quite enough to say, hey, you 15-year-old in a really terrible situation, just know that if you can hold on, right, and you can get out of your small town or you can go, that things will get better. I mean, there's got to be efforts to improve things where teenagers are now. So it goes hand in hand. I mean, I think it's a great project, but it certainly can't be enough. We can't sort of say, well, there's the It Gets Better project, so there's no work left to be done because that's just not the case.
And it's itgetsbetterproject.com?
Yeah.
Okay. Is there anything else you want to say about the book?
Please read it. No, it's been really fun to come back to Montana and talk to Montanans about the book, people who have been to Miles City and in some cases people who have lived in Miles City and have done a couple of events in Miles City. And that's all, obviously very different than talking about the book anywhere else in the country. So that's been really a treat for me. So, but I also love, that I was at the Burlington Book Fest recently and, I've been different places and I love that people who have read the book feel like they've kind of taken a trip to Miles City or they know these landmarks that, that are there, however fictionalized they might be.
Emily Danforth was born and raised in Miles City, Montana. Find more information about her at our blog, therightquestion.blogspot.com. Also there, poems, book reviews, and links to our podcast and Facebook page.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau, Lisa Simon, David Moore, and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. You'll find links to author information, audio, and our Facebook and podcast feeds at therightquestion.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.